The Jericho Network on Westwood One.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzy. Now he's rocking the podcast world. This is Talk Is Jericho. Talk Is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk Is Jericho with Chris Jericho. That's me. I am Chris Jericho. Thank you so much for joining me on the second huge episode of Talk Is Jericho with the return of last week's guest, Steve Austin. Stone Cold Steve Austin will be here. What a great, great first show. Super amazing guest. Super amazing guest. Super funny happy hour. Super amazing guest time. Looking forward to talking more with Steve, who will join us again today. So what did you think of the first podcast? Please let me know at I Am Jericho on the Twitter. Hashtag it Talk Is Jericho. And what I want to do every week is answer some of your questions. So if you have questions that you would like me to answer, once again, send them to me at I Am Jericho, hashtag Talk Is Jericho. And I will do my best to answer anything that you want me to talk about. I'll do that in the first segment of our show. And don't ask me average questions. When are you coming back to wrestling? You know, I mean, it's always a good one. But the answer is, I'm not sure. When I know, you'll be the first one that I talk to about. I will let all of you know. But I think that I would like to kind of take this in all directions for this podcast. This phenomenon known as Talk Is Jericho. Similar to what the Nerdist does, what Chris Hardwick does, or what Adam Carolla does, or what Steve does. I got so many interests, so we can talk about all things WWE, all things Fozzy, heavy metal, music in general, books, TV shows. I'm really into American Horror Story, Coven. Have you guys watched this? It's a great show. What they do is every season they do self-contained stories. So if you haven't seen season one, you can still watch season two, or you can still watch season three, and they don't tie in together. The only similarity is the same actors appear every season, but play different characters. So in the first season, Jessica Lang played like this really weird house owner. Second season, she played a nun in an asylum. Third season, this is called Coven, where she plays the Supreme, which is the head of a coven, kind of a finishing school for girls, but they're all witches. And she plays this amazing, amazing character called Fiona. She's the Supreme Witch, but she's still very vain. Even though she's a witch, she can like start fires and kill people, and she can resurrect people, but she still, I think she has cancer, and she doesn't want to lose her hair, and she's very vain. It's just a really, really incredible, cool show, and it's really sick. It's disgusting. There's so many, like, Kathy Bates plays this, like, voodoo socialite serial killer weirdo who, back in the 1800s, used to keep, like, her slaves literally locked in cages and torture them. Yeah, and this is all on FX, on the FX channel. So then she dies, and then they one of the witches resurrects her. So now she's alive again. She's like, so Kathy Bates versus Jessica Lange versus Patti LuPone, who's amazing on it, versus Angela Bassett. So it's like all these like older MILF diva witches fighting each other. Although I wouldn't call Kathy Bates a MILF. I take that back. Don't really want to call her anything, but she's definitely not a MILF. MILF, of course, being mothers that I love to F. This is a family-friendly show. It's a family-friendly show that we're talking about MILFs. There you go. But they have this really rad scene where there's a council of witches who are kind of following Jessica Lange and her, I guess, her progress as the Supreme. The Supreme is kind of like the head witch. And she has all these crazy bad things that happen, so they're putting her kind of on trial. But then they find out that this one witch is really behind all of Jessica Lange's faux pas. So they decide to burn her. It's like burn the witch. And they walk out to like this place in the desert where there's the stake, and it's kind of like this procession with the witches, and then the witch is going to get burned wearing white, and she's handcuffed. And they've got like the song playing in the background, Dr. John. Could have been the right place, but it was the wrong time. Could have been the right place, but it was the wrong time. Could have been the right place,
but it was the wrong time. Like that sort of, you know, that song. And so it's this kind of cool, like, seven, like, boom, 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 boom. So it's just like this really awesome scene where they lead her to the witch's stake and then they set her on fire. Which is so rad. So if you haven't seen that show, if you're looking for something to replace Dexter or looking for something to replace Breaking Bad, give American Horror Story Coven a try. It's really, really cool. One of my favorites. And we did mention Dexter before. I know this is kind of a few months after it happened, but I have to talk about the Dexter season finale. Pissed me right off. Because to me, Dexter is the tale of two shows. There's the show that is one of the best written, amazing plot twist, killer, no pun intended, shows. And then at its worst, it was like this plot hole filled, just shitty writing, like very lazy writing. And that's kind of how the last episode was. Whereas the last season was pretty good. There's a lot of cool turns and twists and turns. But the last episode was awful because, okay, Deborah dies. I mean, plot spoiler, whatever. If you haven't seen the Dexter season finale yet, I'm going to spoil it for you. Fast forward this. And if you haven't watched it yet and you're mad at me, then I don't care because you should be watching it. So anyway, so Deborah dies like from like natural causes. Like she gets shot or something and like has a heart problem. Like she didn't even die from a serial killer. So it's like the dumbest death ever. And then Dexter goes into the hospital and just walks out the front door holding his sister's dead body, even though there's a hurricane coming. So because there's a hurricane, apparently you're just allowed to walk in the hospital and just take any random dead bodies that you want and walk out the front door. And then he puts Deborah in his boat and drives into the oncoming hurricane, stops driving, takes her body out, throws it in the ocean, watches it sink. Okay, kind of symbolic, not bad. And then drives into the hurricane because he can't survive because he brings bad luck to everybody that he loves. So he leaves his son, he leaves his girlfriend, he leaves his sister, and then rides his boat into the hurricane. Well, not exactly the best finale. He's not exactly a Breaking Bad, but not the worst either. But then, the epilogue, we see him at a log camp, and he's got a long beard, and he's working as a lumberjack. Now, meanwhile, he drove into the hurricane, and now they now find pieces of his boat. Like, the hurricane just blew his boat apart. So what did he do? He swam from southern Miami to Portland, Oregon? Or did he just swim from the middle of the ocean in a hurricane to the shoreline, then get on a plane and fly to Seattle to join the lumberjack camp? Dumbest finale ever. I was so furious. Like, they've got a huge show with a group of writers all gathered around the table, and they're working for months and months and months and months trying to come up with storylines. And this is the best that they can do? Like, who sat there and said, okay, this is great. We're going to make him a lumberjack for the last scene. How amazing will that be? Oh, that's good. That's good. Oh, that's good. And the actors had to go for it and the network, and it's just, ugh, brutal. I'm going to give it a patented Jericho raspberry. The Dexter finale gets a I'm going to start adding that to the show. Every week in the first segment, I'm going to answer one of your questions, but since we just got started, I don't have any yet. At I am Jericho, hashtag talk is Jericho. Ask me questions. Love me. And then I'm going to review something during the week. And if I like it, I'm going to go, yay. And if I don't like it, I'm going to go, pfft. So American Horror Story gets a yay. And the Dexter series finale gets a pfft. There you go. Coming up next, the second part of the amazing Stone Cold Steve Austin interview. And now we're excited to pay some bills so that this podcast can stay free.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You're listening to Talk is Jericho.
So on the line, returning from such an amazing conversation last week. Stone Cold Steve Austin, thank you so much for being back, Steve. It was a great, great show last week. So much cool information and cool stories. We were talking about WCW, and we were talking about Barry Windham and all the experience. How was it working with Ricky Steamboat? Was he one of your favorites when you were starting when you were first starting out?
Well, man, one of my favorites starting out. That guy's one of my favorites, hands down, throughout my whole career. And I remember before I started working with Ricky Steamboat, Ravishing Rick Rude had kind of completed his run with WWF at the time, came down to WCW. So Steamboat and Rude were working a big loop, a big rivalry, and were pretty much, you know, main event, or, you know, maybe Sting was, but, you know, I was somewhere on that card, probably in mid-pack. And Rick got hurt. Rick Rude got hurt, and all of a sudden I jumped in his spot, and I started working with Steamboat, and I tell you what, mister, you talk about an eye-opener. And again, at that point, I'd had a couple years in the business, and I really was, you know, had my mechanical chops going, and all of a sudden you get in there with a guy like Steamboat, who I've seen Steamboat's probably his first few matches that he ever had way back in the day. And that guy was always good. His green stuff is better than many guys' 5 and 8 year stuff.
Yes.
So he was just absolutely incredible. And we had chemistry in the ring. And like I said, you know, last week, he was a guy that, you know, you did something. You grab a headlock on that guy, he's going to top wrist lock. You know, if you headlock, take him over, he's going to head scissor you. You know, you don't have to tell him every move to do. He goes and does that. And that's what's so fun about working with him, because all of a sudden you present him with something, he throws something back, and you think, okay, this is where this guy wants to go, but I'm going here. So, Steamboat, one of the greatest of all time. His fire, his passion, his execution. And it's just a whole gimmick. I mean, Steamboat.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. In 2009, we did a thing where I was working with the Hall of Famers, and it was a handicap match, me versus Snuka, Piper, and Steamboat. And I actually lobbied to get Steamboat in the match. Vince wanted Greg Valentine, but I got Steamboat in there. And Steamboat hadn't worked in probably 5 or 6, 7, 8 years or so. And Steamboat, in his mid-50s, after not working in 7 or 8 years, was still 80% better than 80% of the roster. He was better than almost all the roster at that stage in his career than most of the guys. That's just how naturally good he is.
I think I remember that. Didn't he blow up a little bit towards the end?
He blew up a little bit towards the end because he hadn't worked so much, but we worked again the next night in, a 10-man tag, and he stole the show. And then Vince put him back on the road for the next 5 or 6 months, kind of working as a coach, trainer. And we worked a couple other times. We worked another pay-per-view match, and then we worked 4 singles matches, one of them in Tokyo, one of them in Honolulu, one of them in Greensboro, South Carolina, and all those matches got successively better to where the last one we had was actually one of my favorite matches, like a quote-unquote 5-star match, if you can call it that. He got so good so quickly because he's Steamboat.
Well, you know, again, you know, everything that the guy did looked good, and it didn't hurt.
Yes.
That was the thing, man. I mean, he could do the chops, you know, nothing like Danny Davis chops, man. I remember one time I was in we were doing like it was in Tennessee, and we had to do kind of like a battle royal, and I threw Danny Davis in a corner and chopped him 3 times, and I said, reverse me, start chopping. So Danny reversed me, put me in a turnbuckle, and started chopping my ass off.
Uh-huh.
Holy smokes, I rolled out of that dang, I got out of that corner, got away from Danny, and I remember, you know, I'd already went back to the dressing room, Danny was still working, and I went over to Danny's locker, and I left him a note. I said, screw you. Actually, it said, F you and your chops, Steve. as a rib point, he came. Cause I never called a chop spot with Danny Davis again. But going back to Steamboat, you know, those Steamboat chops, you know, were kind of with a soft hand, and they looked good, but they didn't kill you.
Yeah. Yes, he was very, very, like you said, his work rate was off the charts. It never hurt you, and just a natural. And another natural that you worked with very closely in WCW was Brian Pillman. How did you guys become close? And it doesn't surprise that you did, because you have very similar personalities.
Brian Pillman, we're in Dothan, Alabama, or Columbus, Georgia. It's one of those towns down there when we were based out of WCW, where we did a lot of our television tapings. And man, I was fixing to be put with Harley Race and given a run as United States champion. And so I was really looking forward to that television taping because, man, when you get a chance to run with an 8-time world champion, Harley Race, as your manager, that is going to be a push of a lifetime. And so Dusty's booking the time, and here comes Flying Brian, who I just kind of knew, you know, kind of casually because we were, you know, traveling down the same roads together, being at the same carts. And he comes up to me, you know, Brian, just call everybody Kid. Hey, Kid. That's where I got it from. He goes, hey, Kid, come here. I said, what's going on? He goes, well, we need to come up with a finish. We're a tag team now. I said, what the F are you talking about, dude? I said, I'm fixing to go on a singles run with Harley Race. He goes, no, we're a tag team. We've got to think of a finishing move. Go talk to Dusty.
Wow.
So I went over and talked to Dusty. I said, hey, Dusty. I said, man, what's the deal? Brian says, we're a tag team now. Yeah, baby, we're going to put you guys in a tag team. And so, you know, there we were, a tag team. So that's when, you know, I went out there with those garbage blue and black trunks I had, and Brian had those Cincinnati Bengals trunks, and we were just kind of a interim tag team, seemingly, to get guys over. And so, you know, that's when Brian and I are going to be at the same shows all the time. We started traveling together. And many times Scotty the Body, Raven, would travel with us as well. And we struck up a friendship. The chemistry was developed. Brian came up with the Hollywood Blondes name. He, you know, we got to have gold chains. We got to have matching trunks. We got to have the vests. All Brian's ideas. And we just became like brothers going up and down the road. And when he got in the ring, I could damn near read his mind. When I was in the ring, he could read my mind. You know, this was real tag team wrestling, Chris. Not
right.
This kind of stuff that, you know, you see some guys just get thrown in there and go try to create a tag match. You know, we were really a team. We'd cut off the ring and work together, you know, feet
right.
in on bumps, you know, use the referee in the right way. And so, man, we knew what each other was trying to do. And so I really, really enjoyed working with Flying Brian and really enjoyed, you know, probably just the friendship that I had with him more than anything.
You know, it's interesting to me. Like, I always – they had Eddie Guerrero and I tag in WCW for a short period of time and then kind of cut it off for no apparent reason when I thought we could have been, you know, the biggest thing in the company, or one of them at least, because we had the same thing. Great chemistry, great character, could work with anybody. And I kind of feel they did the same thing with Hollywood Blondes. They kind of cut you guys off too early, in my opinion.
Well, and it doesn't make sense. There wasn't any lack of depth in the singles division, and we got over, you know.
Right.
And a lot of people call the Hollywood Blondes, you know, I don't think we're one of the greatest tag teams of all time, but there are some people who kind of consider us on that list. I think, you know, had we stayed together 2-3 more years, yeah, we could definitely be on that list. But we didn't have enough matches underneath us to really do that. But the thing that's really disappointing to me is tag team wrestling is no longer exists. There are certain guys that are just designed to be tag team wrestlers.
Yeah.
And that's when they're at their best. I mean, just take, for instance, Midnight Express and Rock and Roll Express. For that matter, the Road Warriors, you know, the Killer Bees, you know, those were tag, and I could go on and on and on, but I'm just saying those
sure.
just jump off at me right now. And yeah, on the one off, they could have a singles match every here and there, but you know, it's okay for you know, a team to last 10-15 years. That's awesome, because that's when you really get good tag team wrestling.
Absolutely. And that's something that WWE and WCW had so much depth in the 80s and even early 90s, that they got completely away from that. It's almost like tag team. I think Vince's attitude was, I could just take two guys and put them together and it's the same thing. But it's not, because there's certain psychology. And like you said, even though tag teams, there's a lot of times one stands out more than the other. Bret Hart out of the Hart Foundation, or Shawn out of the Rockers. But, you know, Marty and Jim, they were never bigger than when they're in that tag team. They played that role perfectly.
Yeah, and like you said, you just mentioned, you know, a couple of guys that were going to break out and be big single stars. But again, you know, some of those people, you know, that I mentioned, I mean, they were, you know, tag team wrestlers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And then that's kind of what their niche was.
That's an attraction.
Yes.
Dude, I mean, you know.
I used to love it.
A great tag team match is very hard to beat by a single. There, if you have two over tag teams that are white hot with issues, you know, versus, you know, that white hot singles match, just the dynamics through math of all the different matchups and things that can happen, the tag team, you know, could theoretically steal the show every single night.
I agree, because it gives a little bit of different variety too. Like you said, there's so many combinations and things you can do.
Ways to play that referee.
That's right, exactly. There's so much stuff you can do with a good tag team chemistry, you know. But so the time comes, you end up getting fired from WCW via, was it a phone call or via FedEx?
Yeah, it was a phone call, and the FedEx came the next day.
And what was the reasoning for that?
Well, it was basically exactly what Eric Bischoff said. Steve, based on the amount of days you've been incapacitated and the amount of money we're paying you, we're going to go ahead and exercise our right to terminate the agreement.
Mm-hmm. So
and
you were,
I said,
you were
basically,
hurt?
Basically, you're telling me I'm fired, right? Yeah, you're fired. And yeah, so this is right when I had torn my tricep off my elbow, and I was making my my recovery. I was going to be a few more weeks. I'd been out for several months. You know, when you have a tricep reattached, it takes a while to grow back. So it was during that time, and prior to that, I'd had some knee issues, you know, and messed up some knees. And so, hey, man, I was a hardworking guy and put it all on the line, but, you know, with some debilitating injuries, you just can't make your shots. And so anyway, that was the way he broke down firing me. I think it had something to do with that and him just not seeing, you know, a big future for a guy with thinning, long blonde hair called Stunning Steve Austin. And although I was very... you know, angry when I got fired because, you know, that was my job and I need my job to pay my bills. When I look back and look through Eric Bischoff's eyes at where he was and my look, my character or lack of, and what I was presenting, you know, I don't blame him for making the decision that he made at all.
You know, it's funny because, you know, I was in the same boat and I didn't get fired by Eric, but Eric kind of said the same type of stuff to me as far as not being marketable, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, Eric is a very smart guy, but like you said, it was a different world for him back in those days. And I think, like you said, I don't blame him really for not seeing it in me either, because I was really not showing the same attributes or qualities that I kind of found, you know, years later. So I think a lot of fans or a lot of critics will say, what an idiot, that stupid bastard, you know, fired Austin and let Jericho go and did this and did that. But at the time, maybe we weren't as good as we thought we were.
Well, it's an evolution process, man. I mean, look at a couple of guys, the heavy hitters that you tour with currently, or sometimes, you know, I mean, look at Metallica's start to
when absolutely.
They really got hot. Look at Slayer's start mm-hmm. when they really got hot. I mean, you know, there's an evolution that takes place, and you got to go through those. It's like I could sit there, and I don't like to name names in the current WWE locker room right now of guys that, as we see them now, they're not complete. They're still filling out the process, trying to find out who and what they are, and a lot of guys with substantial television time invested in them. But,
right.
You know, and they'll either find that right combination or they'll continue to be journeymen. So it's always a work in progress, and then you finally stumble across, you know, by hook or by crook, fluke, luck, or planning, what's going to work for you.
Well, and that's the thing. You know, it's interesting to me because we kind of had similar career paths, but in you know, kind of flip-flop versions. But you spent some time in ECW. Do you feel that's kind of where the Stone Cold character had its evolution, or the seeds of the birth of Stone Cold happened in your time in ECW?
Man, a lot of people say that was kind of the genesis or the launching point for, you know, what the promos would become, but. You know, probably I would have to say yes, but not so much Stone Cold. It was the fact that, you know, Paul Lee was able to help me focus and deliver a message with meaning and feeling, because it was a straight-up shoot. And I'm not alluding to a shoot promo, but alluding to what makes a great promo.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I can hear somebody flap their gums all day long, but you got to feel that to believe it. And so Paul Lee, I think, pointed me in the right direction and gave me the platform to do that, whereas I hadn't been before. And any time before when I got any kind of mic time, whether it was with like the Hollywood Blondes or maybe a little bit of a singles type thing, it was kind of following at the time the stereotypical
yes.
Gimmick promo that everybody was cutting, you know, that didn't really carry any weight. I mean, I was attempting to cut those promos that I, you know, emulated those. That weren't really carrying any gravity or weight, you know, I was just a guy with thin and blonde hair flapping his gums.
Well, the best characters are always your natural personality just turned up to the nth degree. And I think that's kind of what the ECW promos allowed you to do. Allowed you to be yourself, basically. Be Steve Austin, sarcastic, over the top, funny, but just do it in a way where you could actually portray this new character that you hadn't, that no one had ever actually seen before.
Well, it was an interesting environment because at that time I really felt that the promos coming out of ECW, by and large, across the board, were the best promos in wrestling at that time.
Well, I agree. I think at that point in time, and it's funny too, because I think it's the impact or the pioneering aspect of ECW has kind of been downplayed over the years. But if you go back to 94, 95, 96, when you were there, when I was there, that was the most revolutionary, quote-unquote, coolest company on the planet, by far.
There was some great stuff going on there, some horrific stuff as well. And, you know, some of the guys, I don't know if you've seen this or not. Have you seen ECW Bar Bar City? It was kind of like a documentary behind the scenes thing. A lot of guys that kind of went through the meat grinder there.
No.
And came out kind of really worse for the wear. An interesting DVD. You ought to get your hands on it. And that could be a conversation for another day down the road. But,
yeah,
you know, there was some really good stuff that came out of ECW and pushed the envelope from a you know, wrestling presentation standpoint, just the organic, raw brutality of it. Again, now, you could go too far in that direction, and it becomes, you know, once you try to keep outdoing yourself with violence, you book yourself in a real hard corner, and I think ultimately that's what happened there. But along the way, it was a great ride.
Did you go there because you had a non-compete? Were you kind of killing off some time before you could go to the WWE, or how did that come about?
No, I didn't have a non-compete, man. I was fired.
Fired.
I was free to go, do whatever I wanted to do. I just, you know, like a while ago, last week we said, you know, you got to pick up the phone and call people.
Right.
But in the wrestling business, you never want to make the first call.
That's true.
You always want the wrestling promoter to call you. So, you know, you're in demand. You're not asking him for a job. Now, don't get me wrong. Many of us have picked up the phone and asked for a job. But in a perfect world, the best situation is for them to call you because they want you, right?
Right.
So,
especially
anyway,
at that stage of the game. Especially
I had already been to, you know, my contract was kind of coming to a close in WCW. I was starting to, I talked to Vince McMahon three times. I'd flown up there the last time, went to his house in Greenwich, talked with him and Bruce Pritchard, and it might have been Jim Ross, but I could see that, you know, they didn't really have any plans for me as far as making me a superstar. They had plans for me to just come in and be a mechanic, another body. You know, I was doing good things in ECW, and they caught wind of that. But still, they weren't ready for me to bring me in as a star. Or,
right.
You know, I thought they'd have a better plan than they did. So I wasn't really interested in going to WWF yet. Paulie called me literally the day after I got fired. My arm was still healing. And so I said, hey, man, when he called me and said, hey, come to work for me. I said, Paul, I can't work. My arm's busted. He goes, you ain't got to work. Just cut promos.
Hmm.
And so we came up with a, you know, a little payment thing that for the how much I would make when I went up there. And, you know, they filmed once a week, and I would fly to Philly, you know, go do my thing, pre-tapes, vignettes, little stuff like that, kind of start working on that character, and it all started from that.
But what I'm saying, though, so finally, they finally made the call to bring you up there when it was time and told you were going to be the ringmaster.
Well, yeah, that's when I'd been working for ECW for
right.
a couple of months. And I lived in a log cabin there in outside of Atlanta, Georgia, on 10 acres. And phone rings, and it was Vince. And Steve, Vince. Hey, Vince, what's going on? Meg, how you doing, pal? Listen, I got a great idea for you. I'd like to bring you in. I'd like to call you the ringmaster. You know, the master of the ring. Well, that Ted DiBiase is your manager. We'll make you the $1 million champion. You come in as a champion. And, yeah, that's it, pal. I want you to be the ringmaster. So, you know, all of a sudden, you know, Vince make you sound like $1 million.
Of course.
So sound like the greatest idea to slice bread.
Of course.
So I said, okay, Vince, sounds good to me, because I was making, you know, whatever I was making at ECW, which wasn't much, one day a week.
Yeah.
I had a family and houses. You know, those gimmicks they sent in the mail called bills, I had a lot of them. So the ringmaster sounds like a premier idea to me. So then they fly me to Chicago. And you remember Terry and Julie, the seamstresses,
yeah,
still work there and make the greatest costumes for the guys in the world. Where they sent me up there to talk with them, and originally they wanted me to wear an emerald green singlet, and you know, because it was the color of money. And you know, I think that was about it. And then I said, no, I think I wore the emerald green trunks one time, I think, and then went back to my basic black trunks. But you know, I think I showed up with Hollywood blonde boots. I had white boots with a black star.
Yeah.
Didn't have a ring vest. I mean, if this was supposed to be the ringmaster and the master of the ring with the $1 million belt, it was a piss poor, a piss poor offering at best. But nonetheless, that was the start.
But you hit the nail on the head. I used to talk with Taker actually about this. How Vince is like a Jedi, a wizard. You could go in there with the worst piece of crap idea, but he would make it sound like it was the greatest thing ever, and you would walk out of there. Out of his office, feeling so excited and so happy, and then 5 minutes later, go like, "What did I just agree to? This is awful."
Well, yeah, but by the same token, you could walk in there, you know, mad as a hornet because of the situation of hand that was going on, and this was pissing you off, that was bothering you, and you had an issue with this, and all of a sudden you walked in there, and you know, do that that famous 60-minute head spin when all of a sudden, blah, 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 blah. Hey, pal guy, you know, shake your head, hit you on the back, see you, walk out the door, you're laughing and joking and smiling, man, that was badass. And you get about another 15 feet down the road, it's like, hold it. Everything is exactly the way it was.
That's right.
I went in. Nothing has changed. The situation is exactly the same, but he Jedi mind tricked you into thinking that everything was
yeah,
cool. So you can't knock on his door and go back because you just shook his hand and told him everything was cool.
Yeah.
He was the master of doing that.
He sure is. Talking about the master, exactly. So you're the ringmaster. I never really even knew what the ringmaster was. It just kind of a guy that was there. You know it's not going anywhere. You know you got to make a change. We all know the story about how you came up with the name Stone Cold, but what was your idea in making this change? Like, what did you want to do? Like, I have to start making a personality out of this, or what was your idea?
Well, you know, first, you know, let me go through the embarrassment of having to be the ringmaster.
Oh, please.
I knew that idea sucked, and you know, as stunning Steve Austin with 6 years in business, you know, I was very respected amongst my peers as being a hard-working
Absolutely.
Mechanic in a ring and a pretty good dude and a guy that was going to give you everything he had and go into the ring. And so all of a sudden, you know, you get that ego check and you lose your identity because studying Steve wasn't much, but it's who I was.
Right.
And so now here's this fresh start as the ringmaster, and you're walking out to the ring and you're just thinking, oh, God, here we go. I'm going to give this my best, you know, and, you know, you... I remember that first promo I did out there with Brother Love, and you know I swung for the fence. I did the best I could, and it was what it was, and it wasn't bad. But you know, it's hard to get out of that frame of mind and have to check that ego at the door. Leave your past
right
behind you, and with 6 years almost basically
yeah
start from scratch. So anyway, then I come up with a Stone Cold name because I know that I'm driving down the road, and this is back when they needed guys for Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart to beat inside the squared circle. I was that guy. So even though I had a bad gimmick, they were calling me the ringmaster, I was working with the best talent in the world. I was working with Shawn and Bret. They were beating me every single night, and I was looking up at the lights, and I didn't mind that one bit. That was great.
Yeah.
And those guys knew that I could go, and it was refreshing for them to be able to work with me, and I could put up and go with them. So I knew that the ringmaster was never going to be on the top of a marquee. I knew that the ringmaster just didn't have the capability to sell T-shirts, and you know, I really didn't have any idea how many T-shirts could be sold. I could look far enough down the road and see ringmasters not being a great gimmick.
But plus, the ringmaster wasn't even a gimmick. What was the gimmick? It was just your name.
He's supposed to be the master of the ring. You know, it's kind of like a play upon the ringmaster of a circus.
No, I got you, but
the guy that's leading everything. So I'm going to be the ultimate wrestler.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So that was basically it. The guy was just a hell of a wrestler. And you know,
gotcha.
By all accounts, I have no amateur wrestling background whatsoever. You know, I'm a football background.
Right.
And I think I know like six holes. And, you know, most of it was beer drinking and middle fingers as it would come to me. But that was okay because the people dug it. But to, so anyway, as the Stone Cold thing started, you know, then it was like, you know, it was all a work in progress and just following into basically me applying my competitive mindset in a shoot sport like football into the creative work aspect of pro wrestling. And that's killer, you know, a killer mentality, bust-assed, you know, think shoot but work and be aggressive and relentless, and that's, you know, kind of what started, you know, and also talking that South Texas trash that I grew up, you know, hearing, you know, all throughout my days of you know, and being here in Texas and hunting and playing football. And so just knowing that I needed to, you know, up who I was from a salt and pepper on a steak. Okay, what you have, Chris, as you know, what you do in the ring is a steak.
Right.
Now, what you do outside of that stuff is the salt and pepper on that steak. And I mean your promos, your look, your nuances, you know, your gear. You know, it's all, but you got to have a base. And your base of what you do is in the squared circle. And I know we've had some great talkers who weren't necessarily great workers. But, you know, it all starts and stops to me with what goes on in the ring, and everything
right.
else, you know, follow suit.
But so tell me about the conversation that you had when you went to Vince to tell him, listen, the ringmaster ain't happening. I want to change to Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah, you know, I'd kind of, you know, seen that that special on that serial killer.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's when they sent me the, you know, all the bad names. But I just.
What was the bad? What was the worst one? Frigid Frank or something?
No. It was Fang McFrost, Autobahn Ruthless, and Ice Dagger, temperature-based name off a cold-blooded guy that I had seen, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I came up with a name, and so then I called Vince. I said, Vince, I said, I got it. I said, man, I said, I want to be called Stone. No, Jerry Briscoe was actually my go-to guy back then. I called Jerry, and I said, hey, Jerry, I said, I came up with a gimmick, my name. I said, I want to be Stone Cold Steve Austin, and I want to be from Victoria, Texas. And Briscoe said, okay, I'll run it by Vince, and we'll run through legal, see what happens.
Yeah.
So anyway, they go through all the things, you know, because they want to trademark everything.
Right.
And it's that starving rock and roll artist, you know, trying to get a chance just to get a product out there or a foot in the door or, you know, some kind of leeway. So, you know, hey, everything clears. You're Stone Cold Steve Austin. You're from Victoria, Texas. And so I remember showing up at TV a week or two later from Victoria, Texas. Stone Cold Steve Austin, no fanfare, no nothing. I remember Scott Hall coming up to me. He just came into company, or we were crossing paths, or whatever the deal was.
Yeah.
Maybe, no, this is before they left.
Right.
This is before they left. And he goes, hey, man, what's with the Stone Cold thing? And I said, hey, man, it's just an idea, you know. It's just, and I kind of cut a little bit of a promo for him. I said, it's just an idea, man. It is what it is. You know, the way, you know,
yes.
Razor talks. He goes, okay, dude. Sure enough, it turned out to be an okay thing.
Yeah, that's right. It sure did. Hey, we'll be right back after this. We're going to pay some bills to keep this podcast free. We're going to talk more with Stone Cold Steve Austin coming up right after this. More Talk of Jericho. Stick around.
This is Talk is Jericho.
Welcome back to the Talk is Jericho. We got Steve Austin here telling some great stories about the ascension of Stone Cold Steve Austin. Obviously, the biggest catchphrase of all time, Austin 316. Was that something that you wrote, or did you just say it off the top of your head?
Hey, man, you know, check it out, Chris. You know, what happened was we were in the Madison Square Garden, and Scott Hall and Kevin Nash were fixing to go down south to WCW, and that's when the infamous curtain call happened.
Right.
And all those guys from the clique went out there and hugged. And so those guys went down south, and Shawn Michaels and Triple H, who had also, you know, been a part of the big hug, they broke kayfabe, you know, in Madison Square Garden, dude, that's hallowed ground.
Absolutely.
You don't break kayfabe back in the day in Madison Square Garden. So those guys went down south. Shawn Michaels, very tempestuous or temperamental back in the day, you know.
Yes.
He could rub Shawn the wrong way, and he had a real bad attitude, and Vince couldn't put the screws to him because he was his number one guy. He was his world champion. So Triple H was going to win the King of the Ring in 1996. He was going to get a big shove. But because of that curtain call, Vince had to put the heat on somebody, and he put it on Triple H. So I remember we was up there in Lowell, Massachusetts one day, somewhere about there, and I'm walking across the parking lot, and I didn't know Vince real well at the time. And he goes, "Hey, Steve, you got a second?" And I said, "Yeah, man, what's going on?" He goes, "Well, I just want to let you know in 2 weeks you're going to win King of the Ring." So I said, "Well, okay." And just went on about my business, you know.
Yeah.
So I was like plan B. So, you know, none of this would have never happened, Chris, had they not done that curtain call. And, you know, Triple H would have got that win. So, as it turns out, we go to Milwaukee Mecca Arena. My first match is with Mark Merrow, and he does a little whirligig movement, and he kicks me in the mouth, busts my lip wide open.
Right.
They take me to the hospital during the middle of the show.
Wow.
I get 14 stitches to close my lip. I come back, and we're going to cut the match down so I ain't got to, you know, screw my lip up. And Vader had done a number on Jake the Snake Roberts' ribs, so Jake was already theoretically incapacitated to a degree. I would take his, you know, advantage of his ribs that were busted up by Vader, take off the ace bandages, hit him with the stunner, and, you know, win the King of the Ring. That's what happened.
Right.
In a fairly short match. So, to kind of protect the mouth and the stitches. So, anyway, before that match happened, I come rolling back in the ambulance, and I'm still in my ring gear. And, man, if Michael P.S. Hayes wouldn't have come up to me and told me, "Hey, man, I just want to let you know that while you were gone, Jake the Snake Roberts cut a religious-based promo on you, so you might want to remember that when you do your King of the Ring speech." And I said, and instantly the John 3:16 popped into my mind, because me being the big football
right.
fan that I am, back in the day, anytime someone kicked the field goal or extra point after a touchdown, there would always be a John 3:16 sign in the football stadium.
Right.
So I said, that's it, Austin 3:16. And that's all I had. And so we go out there. I win the match, go up there. Michael Hayes does the little interview. And, boy, I start rolling. I start running Jake down about getting a cheap ball of Thunderbird and get his ass out of the WWE and all this other stuff. And, you know, basically just off the cuff, I said, you know, you sit there and thump your Bible and say your prayers, and it didn't get you anywhere. You talk about your Psalms, talk about John 3:16. Austin 3:16 says, "I just whooped your ass." And, dude, that's pretty strong back in the day.
Sure thing.
So, anyway, that happened. I hit a grand slam with that one, and I kept running my promo, which was just totally off the cuff, total shoot. And then this was back when Vince was announcing. And on the RF mic, the house mic, I could hear him kind of wrapping things up. So I'm thinking, Vince is trying to throw to another match. I need to wrap up this promo and get out of this.
Right.
So I just said, you know, whoever gets the shot, whether it's Davey Boy or Shawn Michaels, you're looking at the next WWF champion. And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so. So it was total chance, total fluke, and I hit two grand slams at one at-bat that I was never supposed to get in the first place.
And this is when you were still a heel. So they made the Austin 3:16 shirt fairly quickly after that, correct?
Yeah, that's when they made the shirt, and they just started flying off the rack.
Now, is that the highest-selling wrestling T-shirt of all time?
Man, it has been credited as such. I think there's been a few other claims of people that think that they've had the number one selling shirt. But at the peak of the business, the way the merchandise started flying off the rack, you would have to prove to me on paper that there's been a hotter shirt than that one that sold more.
I mean, that shirt was everywhere. I mean, that was the biggest. I remember being in WCW at the time when you did that, or soon afterwards, and everybody in the crowd was wearing an Austin 3:16 shirt. The NWO shirt was popular too, but there was more Austin 3:16 shirts at the WCW shows than any WCW merch for sure.
Yeah, you know, I remember it was funny. One time we were told this wrestling story the other day. We were in Scranton, Pennsylvania, or one of those towns, Hershey. And, you know, it's right when I came back from getting dropped on my head, and they put me in a lot of tag matches, six-man matches, just to kind of get me out there to keep me hot, but also just to come in on a shine spot and not take any bumps. And, man, I went out there, and it was me, Taker, and somebody else against three other guys. And there was a sea of Austin 3:16 shirts out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was incredible. So I tagged in. It had been about a month or two after I'd been back. And took a couple of bumps, you know, just because I had to, you know, for the crowd. And I remember tagging out, and Undertaker looked over at me without breaking his character or his gimmick. And he said underneath his breath, "What the F you doing out there, boy?" Because, you know, I wasn't supposed to be taking any bumps. But I had to because I saw those 316 shirts. So, and it goes like last week we were talking about Undertaker, how funny and cool and
yeah.
You know, low-key. He's like Cool Hand Luke.
Yeah, that's right.
In the Batman persona.
So, I mean, that's actually something, too. When you got, you mentioned getting dropped on your head, it was obviously in a mistimed spot with Owen Hart. Does that still affect you to this day? Is that one of the reasons why you eventually had to retire because of that neck injury?
Yeah, you know, I had some, I bruised my spinal cord, and it kind of made my reflexes in my legs a little different, you know, and a couple other,
you know,
issues, but not to get into detail. But, yeah, I still got some damage from that, and, you know, I always will. But, you know, by and large, you know, for the most part, you know, I get around, do all my normal stuff that I do. I work out like a damn animal again. I just had, you know, last, I think 11 months ago, I had an ACL, PCL put in my left knee.
That's right,
and
yeah.
I'm squatting in the mid-threes for reps now. Don't get me wrong. I'm probably in as good a shape or better shape than I've been in a long time. But it did wreak some havoc that, you know, was kind of half-assed, irreversible.
Which is so ironic because it was right on the cusp of you getting to become this super, super duper star. It must have been kind of a scary moment to know how close you came to not ever working again or walking even.
Hey, man, when that happens, when you get dropped on your head, you know, the top of your head, it's like I watch a lot of football, and that's called an axial load, and that compresses the C3, 4, or 4, 5 vertebrae, and that's the number one cause of quadriplegia in football
right.
players or, you know, in accidents. A lot of people think a whiplash is what does it. No, it's not. It's getting dropped and compressing those nerves. And, you know, on top of that, I had some spinal stenosis without a whole lot of room in that spinal cord to deal with anyway. So, you know, I'll tell you what, man, when you're laying in there in front of 20,000 people and you can't move nothing and you look at the lights, it'll scare the hell out of you.
Yeah.
And it, you know, kind of hurt, too. You know, so,
yeah.
It was a tough day at the office, but, you know, hey, man, things happen in a ring, and that was mm-hmm. one of those things. But it wasn't fun, and it scared the hell out of me. But, you know, I look back and I watch that thing. I've watched that replay, man, a couple hundred times out there throughout the year.
Really?
For a while, you know, it helped me deal with, you know, where I was and, you know, why I had to retire. So, you know, now I don't watch it at all.
Sure.
As a coping mechanism, back in the day, I did.
Well, let's move forward to one of my favorite matches in WrestleMania history, if not my favorite, WrestleMania 13, Austin versus Bret Hart. The reason why I love this match, it was the ultimate double turn that, in my opinion, the fans didn't know they wanted, even though they wanted it until you gave it to them. How did you guys put together that match? Was that mostly called in the ring? What was the mindset behind it? And how was it working with Bret Hart as a performer?
Well, you know, when Bret made his comeback, you know, he had taken some time off to have some shave down in his knee in 96. So when he came back to SummerSlam, I think that was at Madison Square Garden, he requested working with me. And like Bret has gone on record as saying, he saw me coming a long time before I did and knew that, you know, we could make money together.
Right.
And I'll never forget the first time I worked Shawn Michaels in Houston at the Summit. You know, Bret was on the main event that night, or maybe he'd already worked, and I was working with Shawn Michaels, and we tore the house down. And Bret came up to me and goes, "Hey, man, that was a good match." He goes, "I'll work with you any day of the week."
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Thanks, man." And, you know, Bret Hart was always cool.
Yeah.
So, anyway, and as far as WrestleMania 13 goes, I'll never forget, you know, we go into the finish room. Well, let me go back. I had hurt a knee. I was sitting on my house on Monday Night Raw in San Antonio, and that's when I heard the matchup in a submission match, Stone Cold Steve Austin versus Bret the Hitman Hart.
Oh, you didn't know
and
about
I'm
it?
Not a submission. No, man, I'm not a submission wrestler either. So I was mad as a hornet. And so I'm wondering how we're going to, you know, accomplish this match. And we kind of changed it to the kind of the ramifications that it did. So we go to the finish room, and it's me, Bret, and Vince. And, you know, hey, man, you're going to pass out in a sharpshooter. And I'm sitting there thinking, okay. You know, of course, Bret's down with it. And, you know, so anyway, we left the finish room. Mm-hmm. I kind of walked around the arena for a little bit, came back, talked to Vince about 15 minutes later, and said, "Hey, Vince," I said, "are you sure this finish is going to work?" And he goes, "Steve, I'm telling you, it'll work." And I said, okay. And yeah, man, this is your promoter. You know, sometimes
right.
I think Vince has made a bad call every now and then, but you know, when you have the guy who owns the company telling you,
that's,
you know,
right,
and he's in the business to make money, you've got to believe it.
Absolutely.
He has that knowledge, and you know, we're all trying to make money. So if he believes it's going to make money, I'm on board. So we did it. Me and Brett went out to the arena. We just kind of milled around a little bit and talked. And, man, Chris, if you just kind of held your hand out in front of you and spread your fingers, you could look at the fingers as being main points. And then all the rest was gaps to be filled in.
Right.
That's what we went out to the ring with that night. That's why there was nothing to follow. That's why it flowed like it did. And it was basically, by and large, for the most part, called in the ring. And if you watched the match specifically, you can, you know, you'll never see a mouth move, but you can see instances of communication,
right,
as I'm laying it down. And the match happened like it did. And then, you know, the blood on top of the sharpshooter, the ending image of me passing out, and then Brett doing his, you know, altercation with Shamrock, backing down from the challenge, you know, got me over as the you know, work in progress as a babyface and work in progress for him to be a heel.
It's an iconic image of you and the sharpshooter with the blood streaming down your face. Was that part of the finish that you had talked with Vince as well?
No.
Wow.
That was a special added ingredient.
Wow. That was called on the fly?
Called on the fly and delivered effectively.
Wow. What was Vince's reaction to that?
Well, I mean, that was one of those, you know, when you have a match which is so incredible and then you come back and everybody's just going ape shit over it?
Yeah.
And it's like, and that was a very special match. So it was in a period where there wasn't any color. You know, it's kind of like a code.
Yes.
Getting color right now. Well, we got color, but it wasn't called by anybody of authority. So it happened something with me and Brett. And boy, I tell you what, you know, he knew that blood was the exclamation point on a sentence in all caps.
Yes.
We did the right thing. We were headed in the right direction. That added a huge dynamic to what had just happened. Helped tell that story in color, no pun intended. So he had no issues with that.
You know, it's so amazing, I mean, how much the business has changed over the last 15 years or so, in that you guys had that ability to do that and go out there and make the call, know that it's going to work, know that it's going to make everybody huge, huge money, and come back and get, you know, patted on the back. If that happened nowadays, it doesn't matter who it was, you would be so much in trouble, fined, suspended, fired, or whatever. I liked it kind of back in those days when Vince would let the professionals be professional and not have to know about every little single thing that was going to happen, especially if it was the right call.
Well, the biggest thing for me, yes, I agree with you, and I just feel so, bad is the word, but the landscape has changed so much. It's almost like these guys are walking on eggshells.
Absolutely.
Everything that they do in every aspect or regard of maybe not even just their life, but it's, you know, for damn sure their professional life as a sports entertainer employed by that company. And, man, as a person who watches every now and then now, I love the business. I'm still part of the WWE, and I still love the guys and gals that are doing it, but they've taken so much away from them that it's hard for them to go out and experience, really.
Yes.
What it's like to go out there and try to pick a path and have that, you know, okay, they're not buying this, I've got to switch gears and go in a different direction. So they've taken away a lot of the performance dynamics that go out with thinking on your feet, succeeding,
yeah,
or failing, having a change of direction, and calling an audible. And sometimes, you watch all the matches on a card and, you know, and everybody for some reason is working the headlock. Okay, well, I was planning on working the headlock, but since I watched all the matches, I'm either going to work a leg or an arm or,
yeah,
back or something else. Got to call something on the fly. And then, you know, sometimes you go out there and it might be, you know, somewhere in Germany, UK, and they're buying something completely different that they would buy in the States.
Right.
And go out there and just do that. But just as far as going back specifically to what you're talking about, they're basically dictating, you know, what you can and can't do in that ring.
Well, and even in the promos, there will never be another Austin 316 that's called on the fly, because you would have to approve it and you would have to get it written, and nobody would want to take a chance of just doing something on the fly because they think they're going to get heat for it.
Well, especially with the fact that, you know, you have TNA as maybe, I don't really call
yeah.
it. I love TNA. I love the guys that I know have jobs down there, and I love pro wrestling. But, you know, so I'm not saying you have an alternative because you're probably going to be in a no-compete for a year.
That's right.
So with you know, basically it's a monopoly, and you have no power.
No.
If you get fired or if you get in the doghouse, you're really in a bad place with no leverage.
Yeah, you're pretty much finished. So once again, like you said, that kills the confidence, that kills the rebel spirit of being in this business, and it also kind of kills the breakout characters that just happen almost organically, the way that Steve Austin, Stone Cold Steve Austin, broke out. Do you feel that... that Steve Austin became the biggest star in wrestling during the Mike Tyson feud leading up to WrestleMania with Shawn Michaels?
Yeah, I do.
I think it was just an amazing... I think Vince was so perfect. I remember that opening kind of promo that you guys had where you pushed Tyson and Vince was freaking out saying, you're ruining everything. Like, it's almost like without Vince McMahon, there wouldn't have been a Stone Cold Steve Austin as well, with the Vince McMahon character, I should say.
Well, there would have been a Stone Cold Steve Austin. There just wouldn't have been that angle. So certainly that angle would have been. But again, who knows if that angle would have crossed into pop culture or just
right.
Locker room or just water cooler conversation through accounting firms. I mean, everybody was watching that stuff. Back
everybody
then. Who didn't watch wrestling watched it. So yeah, maybe. Probably for sure wouldn't have had the crossover. Stone Cold still would have had a great career, but make no mistake about it, Vince McMahon and Stone Cold Steve Austin, as far as feuding together and working together, was absolutely made for each other. And I've always said, you know, out of all the cats I've ever worked with, you know, Vince is a clumsy, clumsy guy.
Yeah.
But he's one of my favorite guys to work with because everything that I put out from what I feel about the business into him, I get the exact same back. Just the way he, you know, loves to be hated. You know, that was his role.
Yes.
Back was that heat standpoint and, you know, the voice of authority. And the deliverance of authority was, you know, that was his power. And for those two dynamics to what Stone Cold was with, represented versus what he represented, it was absolutely box office gold.
Well, it was perfect, too, because you were every man, like you mentioned earlier. Middle fingers, drinking beer, and beating up your boss. I mean, it's the people were living vicariously through you. Who wouldn't want to give their boss, you know, kick him in the face or you know, stick a enema up their ass or whatever it was? What do you think it was that made Stone Cold so ridiculously over?
Man, that's an interesting question because I remember back in the day, I used to read a couple of things put out by some of the sheets or maybe it was a Vince Russo comment, and I can't hold him accountable for this because I don't know that he said this, but I've heard some wrestling pundits argue that anybody could have been Stone Cold given the storylines that I was. You know, I was just a guy that was doing it, but anybody could have done the same things I did, put into the same scenario, which is an absolute ridiculous
completely,
statement.
Absolutely.
That's like saying that anybody could have been The Undertaker.
Yeah.
Nobody could have been The Undertaker but The Undertaker. Yeah, could you have called someone else that? Yes. But would he have went 20-0, commanded the respect of a
no,
locker room
of course
for 20
not.
Years?
It's ridiculous.
And, you know, the far-reaching effects and the run that he's had?
Mm-hmm.
No. So what it is that got Stone Cold Steve Austin so damn over, it's hard for me to just sit there and flap my gums and say that I know, because I really don't know. I just know that I worked real hard to try to put on a damn good show. And again, by and large, that's me turned up in a competitive environment, the environment of sports entertainment, thinking shoot but working, and you know, using my competitive attributes in a competitive environment, and not being afraid to go out on a limb. Because you ain't got to push me out there. I'll go out on a limb. You might have to reel me in a little bit.
Right.
A couple times he did. But just go out there in the vein of entertainment and put on a show. And, you know, again, a lot of my stuff was a fluke and luck because of, you know, the things that happened. But for some reason, sometimes, Chris, I sometimes believe in a little bit of predestiny.
Yes.
I think you can alter that course, but also, and I don't think everything is absolutely laid out for you, but for some reason, the things that have happened in my life and my journey to be that guy and now where I'm at now, you just always seem to work out. Even when the chips are down with the injuries or whatnot, I always found a way to get back on my horse. And, hey, man, at the end of the day, you know how it is. Just give it everything you got.
Well, I think that's exactly the point of what I was saying, and I think it's very interesting to me how huge Steve Austin was. As far as there's been a lot of discussion over the last few weeks over Triple H did a promo talking about you were never the guy. Well, to me, there's only four guys in the modern era of the WWE that were the guy. That was Hogan, it was Austin, it was Rock, and it's John Cena. It's interesting to me that there was two huge super duper stars working at the same time in the same company as you and The Rock. We'll never see characters that over, that popular, but still very different from each other. Rock was kind of the more, you know, metrosexual type guy or whatever, and you were Stone Cold Steve Austin, every man. How fun was it for you to work with The Rock, having somebody that's just as popular and just as over or very close in the company with you at that time?
Man, it's... You want that, Chris, because you know you want the person you're dancing with to be as over, more over, whatever.
That's right.
That's, you know, you want the best dance partner you can have. And so the fact that Rock and I had great chemistry, we loved working with each other. We were built for each other. I brought out the best in him. He brought out the best in me. So we had that. But on top of that, when you have the people that were loving me or hating him, or later, you know, loving me and loving him from a WrestleMania 17 standpoint. We were Houston-based, so he had a little bit of heel dynamic, but just two over guys. Hey, man, you that's something that you pray for every single night, is to work with a cat that's over like a, you know, hell.
Right. Oh, totally. And that's why it worked so well. Like I said, it was almost catching lightning in the bottle to have a Steve Austin and a Rock together. Do you feel that in retrospect that it was the wrong move for you to turn heel when you did after working with Rock at WrestleMania?
Oh, Chris. Worst call I ever made in my life other than refusing a job for Brock Lesnar at Atlanta. But, you know, that was my idea. And Vince always likes to do something big at WrestleMania. He didn't
right.
have anything big planned. So me being the rocket scientist that I am, you know, I figured, okay, when you're a hot babyface and you turn heel, you're a hot-ass heel and you can draw money like that. And you know,
right.
Or vice versa. You know, and by and large, that is true for the most part, if the time is right to turn.
Mm-hmm.
Well, clearly the time wasn't right for me to turn. I was like, you know, to put it into terms like this, it was like everybody loved John Wayne for what he stood for. And so he did not ever need to be a bad guy in one of his movies. It never was.
Right.
So, you know, people didn't want to hate me. So, you know, but me, because I always loved working heel more than a babyface. So it was going to be a chance for me to have fun, go back to working heel, doing what I love to do. And with that being said, I love working babyface too. Obviously, it's where I made my money. But I liked working heel. I like being a piece of trash. I like talking trash. I like cheating. You know, that was
right.
my style of wrestling. And I did a lot of that as Stone Cold Babyface. But anyway, so it was a bad idea, but Vince bought into it with me. And if I could go back in time, I would have done the exact same match with The Rock, hit him with the chair, and then when Vince and I went to shake hands, I would have said, watch the stunner. I would have kicked him in his gut, and I would have dropped him on his chin, and then I told him backstage, hey, dude, it just wasn't right. I wasn't feeling it.
Right.
And that's what I wish I would have done. So, no, the heel turn was a bad idea. It was 100% my idea. I've got to own that.
Well, you know, it's interesting. The one good thing that came out of it is probably one of my favorite matches I've ever had in my career, which technically doesn't exist because of what happened with Chris at the end of his life. But it was the power trip of you and Hunter against me and Benoit in San Jose on Raw for the tag team titles. That was one of the greatest matches I've ever been involved with. Do you remember that?
Man, I gotta get back on YouTube and watch that. It's been a long ass time.
Go watch it. It's funny because you know some internet sites and wrestling pundits, as you use the word, have voted it as the greatest Raw match of all time, and it is. I watched it the other day. Just it was the anniversary of it. Someone smartened me up about it on Twitter, and I watched it back. And it was such a great match, and the crowd was so insane, and we had a great match, man. You should go check it out. The finish of that match is one of the best.
How much time did they
give us? We had about 20 minutes, maybe 25 minutes. It was a long match. It's the match where Hunter tore his quad.
Oh, yeah. I still remember the inner workings of that, but yeah, I certainly remember that.
Yeah, it was a great moment. But let me ask you another question. You mentioned, you said your other regret is when you walked out refusing to do a job for Brock Lesnar. Why in retrospect did you think that was the wrong move?
Well, I handled the situation like a total ass, you know.
Yeah.
What had happened? Long story short, you know, I was working Columbus the night before Monday Night Raw. I was working Flair in a cage. Jim Ross calls me. I'm laying in a hotel, and just kind of resting up for the match because I'd got into town early, made the drive, and he told me creative and told me they wanted Brock to beat me. And I'm thinking, okay, hold it. I'm drawing stupid money right now.
Right.
And you know, obviously now WWF has spent a lot of money getting me in this position. I busted my ass getting myself in this position. Guys that draw stupid money don't just happen overnight.
Yes.
So then all of a sudden, you want me to do a job for a guy. Now, I love Brock Lesnar, and, you know, he's a monster. And as soon as he walked in the doors, everybody saw massive potential in the guy. But, you know, for me to do a job for him without any kind of buildup, or, you know, it's a match with no, you know, 2 or 3 weeks talking about, or this
right.
pay-per-view match is what it was.
Yeah.
So anyway, he told me to creative. I said, well, if, you know, that's going to be the case, I won't be there. And so he said, okay, I'm just telling you what the old man told me. So he calls the old man and tells him. Jim calls me back. Hey, call the old man when you get through working. Vince gives me the scenario over the phone. And I said, that's what we're doing, huh? He goes, that's what we're doing. And I said, okay. Well, when I said okay, and you can't see my eyes, I mean, okay, I ain't going to be there.
Right.
So that's why I don't like phone calls when we're talking business. So anyway, and me being at the place I was in my head at the time, you know, I was drinking a lot of damn whiskey and beer. And, hey, I showed up every night. I was the first guy in the dressing room. I was the last guy to leave, and I worked my ass off. But, yeah, man, you know, we were running hard back in, Chris,
yep.
You know.
I sure were.
And
sure
so
were.
I just said, piss on these guys. I said, you know, why would they try to do this? Anyway, I got on the airplane, flew back to San Antonio. It was stupid, Chris, because, you know, you got to own up to some responsibility and accountability and show up. And honor your deal, and you know you're packed with the boys and your job. And so I should have showed up like a man, come up with a solution. Could have been a different solution. Could have been just don't even do the match, but show up and talk to Vince face to face, solve the problem in some way, some fashion, and get through it like, you know, a grown man. And, you know, like I said, I took my ball and went home. But I thought I was being poked with a stick. I thought my reason was valid. That being said, I handled it about as badly as you could. And that's just the biggest regret I have in my career as a pro wrestler.
It's interesting, though, man. Like you said, sometimes it's hard to see the forest through the trees. And when you're on the road like that, I've been through it before, too. You do crazy things. You make stupid decisions because it's a lot of pressure, and it's not easy being on the road. It's very, very hard. So sometimes you do make the wrong decisions. A decision that you didn't get to make on your own is when you had to retire when your neck was too bad and all the things went wrong. How was it for you? Was it hard having to step down knowing that your body had given out on you? Was that a hard pill to swallow?
Boy, I tell you what, yeah, it took a couple of years to swallow that pill, and it was a bad part of my life, and you know, I hunted, I fished, I drank a lot of damn whiskey, and just tried to turn back, as I call it, into a civilian. You know, I wasn't a road warrior anymore, going up and down the roads. And you know, my single mission in life was to be a pro wrestler since my rock star dreams had been crushed.
Yeah.
And there I was at on top of the world riding a damn lightning bolt. And all of a sudden someone says, all right, dude, get off your lightning bolt and just go back to living a normal life. very hard to do, and it took me a couple of years to come to grips with it. But now, you know, I did. That's been obviously several years ago now. People always ask me, they say, man, don't you miss the business? And I can honestly tell them, yeah, I used to miss the business. Now when I look back, I have so many fond memories of when I was in the business. But to answer your question, I don't miss the business, but I do still love it.
Would you ever go back for another match?
You know, that's the thing, Chris. It's, you know, it's like, why? Because, you know, why?
Right.
You go to WrestleMania and to totally prepare for that. How long have you been out now?
I come and go, man, but I've been gone for about 5 months, and every single day people ask me, when are you going back? It doesn't matter what I do. So I know where they're coming from.
I still train in the gym very hard, but I've done no cardio. To totally get ready for a high-caliber match like WrestleMania 30, I would think that would need a three-month training window.
Right.
For timing, getting back in the ring, taking bumps. I mean, to do it right. So then you do that, and you bump for 3 months. You get into storylines. You go, you know, to the Monday Night Raws. You do the creative. You have the big blast-off match at WrestleMania, and then there it is. There's the big match at WrestleMania. Then what?
Then,
you know?
Yeah.
You know, then 3 months later, you're going to get your paycheck after all the pay-per-view counts come back, and then you cash the check. Then what? You know?
Yeah.
You know, where do you go?
Well, you know what the fans are going to ask you? When are you coming back? When are you coming back?
You can make some money, but it's just like, dude, you get all revved up, and then you have your 30-minute window, and then it's like, then what? Hey, man, then you got to, you know, decompress, download, I mean, maybe recover. I mean, you know, you got yourself back into mode.
Right.
I know where I'm at in my life right now where, you know, anything's possible. Being involved in some capacity would be fun. But also, Chris, like this, you know, being very, very candid, I like the way I operated back then. I like the way the landscape was back then. I like the creative liberties and freedoms I had back then. I don't know that walking in there right now, I would have those same freedoms, mm-hmm. and I don't know that I could operate in that system.
Right. I got you, man. Like you said, times change, and you know, I respect that. You know, I think it takes a lot to kind of, like you said, decompress and get out of the wrestling business. The cool thing is, though, is that you have other options, as do I, to still stay creative and still entertain. Because that's what we do. We're showmen. And wrestling was just one part of what we do, of what we did. And there's so much more that we can do and are doing. Two last questions, Steve. Favorite opponent?
Oh, but before you ask those two last questions, just let me say that, you know, when I say what next, I mean that on a personal front for me, Steve Austin, as a person, because I know there's so many of my fans that follow me on Twitter and who listen to my show, the Steve Austin Show, that would love to see me in a match. And I love my fans first and foremost, and they're people that you know, I worked hard for to build up that fan base. They've been very, very loyal to me, and I really, really treasure them. And I know they'd like to see me in a match, but you just got to understand that the shoes that I'm in now and where I'm at now, and so I don't say that to insult you or that you wouldn't want me to be in another match. It's just a personal thing with me. Again, I love the wrestling fans, my fans, and I love the WWE. Please ask me your last two questions.
Yeah, no, like just to finish, follow up on that, I think that's why our fans are so amazing. They would love to see us wrestling until we're like 80 years old, but
can't do it.
It doesn't work that way. Favorite opponent of all time?
Well, I tell you what, that's just so – I never work with Steamboat in a high-profile thing, but just think so much of him. But then, you know, just Bret the Hitman Hart, just because I'm such a fan of Bret.
Right.
I think a lot of guys who made money in the business, I know some of them respect Bret. A lot of people just think Bret wasn't all that much. Bret Hart is one of the greatest of all time, man. I love watching that guy's matches. I love it. I love working with him. just because he was at a very high level in a low-key way. I liked what he brought to the whole game. Mm-hmm. And then I would have to say The Rock, just from a pure – again, I was built to work with that guy. He was built to work with me. Obviously, we've had great matches with other people.
Right.
But when you talk about putting just two cats in the ring at any time, if you could tell me, okay, you're working with Rock, badass. You tell me you're working with Bret Hart, badass. Don't get me wrong. You got your Shawn Michaels.
Sure.
You got people. But if you're just talking about – I got to say those two rather than just one.
Sure, of course. Now, if the one match that stands out in your head, not maybe your favorite match or favorite matches?
I got to just go with 13 because of what it meant to me as far as getting me, you know, in babyface mode and to further facilitate things. I mean, the first match that we had, I think, was in Survivor Series in 96 was a starting point, but 13 for what it meant to the business, for the business, for both of our careers. And then 17, just from an electrical standpoint, new attendance record in the Astrodome, two of the hottest cats in one of the hottest periods ever in the history of pro wrestling, lighting it up in five-star fashion, 17.
Amazing, amazing matches and amazing conversation, Steve. I really appreciate it. This has been so cool to talk with you and hear all this stuff. Obviously, Steve Austin Show available on Podcast One. Steve is on Twitter at Steve Austin BSR. Is that correct?
You got it.
And do we see another season of Redneck Island?
You know, I'm hearing good things that there will be a season 4. I think I should have that news in another couple of weeks. And I've got another thing that I'm fixed to announce. Can't do that yet, but I've got some good things going on in the pipeline. I'm hard at work creating some audio whoop-ass of my own on my podcast, but those outside projects keep rolling in, and I'm staying about as busy as I want to, and I've been very thankful to stay like I have.
Well, Steve, like I said, man, what you see is what you get with you. You're always one of my favorite people that I've met in the business and in life. And thank you so much for doing this show. And we'll get a chance to talk with you very soon, my friend.
Hey, man, always good talking to you. And I'd love to have you on my show here in a couple weeks when you get dialed in and ready to rock and roll with me.
Anytime, man. Anytime. I'd love it.
I'll let you get a couple shows underneath your belt and just so we'll have some stuff to talk about and some common ground.
Sounds good, Steve. I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much.
Always. Take care, Chris.
You too, brother. Steve Austin, one of the biggest stars of all time. A great guy. And thanks to him for joining me on Talk is Jericho. Thanks to all of you for joining me on Talk is Jericho. We'll see you next week right here. Stay cool. Stay hard. God bless you all. Good night.
Thanks for listening to Talk is Jericho. Don't forget, every Wednesday there's a brand new episode of Talk is Jericho at podcast1.com.